Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for February 5th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, graphene transistors operating twice as fast as silicon, the trade-off between detection and localization, and boosting the 2011 U.S. science budget. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about foster care for chimpanzees, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The fundamental element in any modern electronic device is the transistor, the basic function of which is to act as a switch or amplify electronic signals. Typically, transistors are made from semiconductors, especially silicon, which is how Silicon Valley got its name. But in a paper in this week's Science, Yuming Lin, Faden Avuris, and colleagues report using graphene to make transistors. Now, graphene has some unusual electronic properties, and in particular, as the authors report, their graphene field effect transistor is capable of operating at 100 gigahertz, or 2.5 times faster than a comparable state-of-the-art silicon transistor. I spoke with Avuris and Lin from their offices at IBM's Watson Research Center in New York. Here's Yuming Lin.
So what's significant about what we have done here is that the graphene are fabricated on a 2-inch silicon carbide wafer. So this is an industrial compatible process that make it possible to make even industrial scaled fabrication and applications.
Faden, how does the performance of your team's graphene-based transistor compare with the best transistors currently out there?
Well, at this point, it's not the optimized device, but already if we compare it with, say, silicon-based metal oxide semiconducting devices, it performs better for its width. The performance of field effect transistors is determined to a large extent by their size. This is the scaling problem in field effect transistors. That's how silicon has progressed over the years. You've heard of Moore's Law and all this kind of discussions about making the devices smaller and faster. So we have to compare the same kind of gate length. And if we take the gate length of our device, which is 240 nanometers, and compare with a silicon device of the same gate length, our device achieved a performance called cutoff, a so-called frequency of 100 gigahertz. The corresponding silicon device would be 40 gigahertz. So it is better at this point, but we certainly expect that it will be further improved by optimizing a number of parameters, among them the scaling, making the device much smaller.
But already 2.5 times better, it sounds like, in terms
of... At this point, yes.
What is it about either the graphene or the way that you and your team employed it in constructing these transistors that makes it perform so much better than silicon-based transistors?
I'll take the question.
Yuming, go ahead.
So compared to silicon, graphene in itself has a very high carrier mobility.
The carrier being?
Electric carriers. In
okay.
This case, it's electrons. Now, this mobility reflects, to some extent, the speed at which the carrier moves in the channel. Now, graphene in itself, we know that intrinsic mobilities can be orders of magnitude higher than that of silicon semiconductor. So that's why graphene has been proposed to be used in this high-frequency or high-speed electronics because of this property. So that's why graphene has this potential to outperform silicon and maybe other semiconducting materials as well. And another advantage that we have identified here is the process itself, that we were able to optimize the process so that the graphene property does not get degraded during the fabrication process. For example, this oxide deposition process, which is necessary for the top gate structure, has been optimized so that the graphene mobility, this mobility of carriers, which is electron, was able to be maintained during the process.
How did you go about that?
So, for example, we know that the graphene is different from other type of materials, that the surface is quite inert to a number of chemicals that's used in the oxide deposition. So basically what would happen is that if you try to coat graphene with a layer of oxide, you end up with non-uniform coating and a lot of pinholes. And in order to overcome that, we have to functionalize graphene, that is to coat graphene with something else to promote the growth of a uniform oxide layer on graphene. Now, this layer is called seed layer, and we don't want a strong interaction of this seed layer and graphene so that it does not affect the quality of graphene after the oxide deposition. And so we have tried several different approaches. And the recent approach that enabled this high-performance graphene transistor was the use of a polymer seed layer. This is a process that is quite different from conventional process in the silicon technology. And this is something that we have spent extra time in trying to optimize the process. And also another challenge is to obtain this wafer-scale graphene material in order to make the multiple devices with consistent performance.
How about the durability of these graphene-based transistors in use? You said it wasn't degraded during fabrication, but what about use?
It also holds up pretty well over time. The device that we reported in this paper was actually fabricated in June, but when we measure it after 3 months, it still performs pretty well.
To manufacturing then, Faden, how well or poorly does this fabrication process scale up?
The key advantage of graphene as a substitute for, say, silicon or 3-5 semiconductors in the manufacturing of high-frequency FETs, field effect transistors, is the fact that it's a planar material. It's a flat sheet of atomic dimensions. And you can use all the same kind of processing technologies that have been developed over the years for the silicon industry. The key to implementing these technologies, of course, is that you have a large area of uniform graphene. And graphene research started by taking graphite, which is a multi-layer structure involving graphene layers, and peeling one out. Certainly, that is not a process that can be adapted for industrial applications. So we have used a growth process that produces wafer-scale graphene. And as already Dr. Lin indicated, we used a 2-inch wafer. Obviously, a 2-inch wafer is still not enough. Right now, silicon technology uses 8-inch silicon wafers. So the next step is to increase the size of the graphene, and also, of course, improve the uniformity, because still there are issues with the uniformity of the graphene over the surface of the wafer. But apart from that, most of the other fabrication steps are well known and optimized over the years in silicon technology. So it's ideal. Not only the physical properties are better than silicon, but you can use established techniques to fabricate.
So we might be seeing them competitively on the market then?
I hope so. Of course, we have to reflect on what the application is. This is for high-frequency transistors. This is not for digital transistors used, say, in computers and logic, which, fortunately, at this stage, graphene does not allow to produce because it's not a real semiconductor and doesn't have a band gap like silicon. So it's for high-frequency applications, analog type of electronics. So there is a nice market for it, for communications and imaging, radar, and all kinds of high-frequency applications, but not for logic yet. I should add, we are working in our group to develop a band gap in graphene. And just 2 weeks ago, we had a publication in Nano Letters, which demonstrated the opening of a band gap in a bilayer graphene. So we hope that in the future, we will be able to use graphene for both high frequency and digital electronics.
Feda Navouris and Yuming Lin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Faden Navouris and Yuming Lin from IBM's Watson Research Center on the high-frequency performance of graphene field effect transistors. This week, the British medical journal, The Lancet, formally retracted a 1998 study that linked autism to vaccinations for measles, mumps, and rubella. Here with more about it is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
The study, led by British researcher Andrew Wakefield, has been considered one of the major catalysts of the autism vaccine scare, to which some have attributed a worrisome decline in childhood vaccination rates. The retraction was motivated in part by last week's findings from the United Kingdom General Medical Council, which concluded that Wakefield's irresponsible and dishonest conduct could support a finding of serious professional misconduct. The council was careful to note, however, that while it considered the concept of research ethics and research governance, the case was not concerned with whether there is or might be any link between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination and autism. Wakefield continues to stand by his paper. However, 10 of the 13 co-authors disavowed it several years ago, and this link between autism and the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination has been debunked repeatedly by several subsequent large-scale studies. Still, some policymakers continue to believe there is a link. One prominent example is U.S. Senator John McCain, who during a speech while campaigning for president in 2008 connected autism to a preservative once found in many vaccines.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Unlike most other bats, Egyptian fruit bats generate pairs of clicks for their sonar, bouncing the sounds off objects that provide information to the bat about where things are. And curiously, the bats can send each click in the pair off in a different direction, right or left, and can precisely vary how far to the right and how far to the left each click goes. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Nahum Ulanovsky and colleagues report that by doing this, the bats can optimize their ability to localize a target. The research suggests that there's a trade-off between the best way to detect an object and the best way to track it. And that's not just for detecting or tracking with one's hearing, but for detecting and tracking an object with any of the active senses, including sight and smell. I spoke with Ulanovsky from his office at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel.
So typically, when we think about tracking an object, we think about watching or looking at the center of the object, let's say if we're using our vision. And this has also been the common thought for echolocating bats that use their sonar beam to track objects. And there were some data to support it that bats put the maximal energy of their beam onto the target. And now we've shown that at least one type of bat, the Egyptian fruit bat, is doing something very different. They're putting the beam off axis, and we've shown this to be actually an optimal way to track objects.
What does it mean, off axis, not putting the beam right on the target?
Off axis means that if you think of the analogy of a flashlight, so if you want to track a small target at night, so putting on axis would mean just shining your flashlight at the target, straight at the target. Off axis means putting it slightly to the side so that the target is a bit to the side from the center. So it sounds like it's less of a good way to track a target, but it turns out that for detection, for seeing the target, let's say in the flashlight analogy, it's indeed less good. You see it less brightly. But being on the slope of the light beam, actually you are more sensitive to changes in the target's direction, and then for sensing these changes in location and thus for better localization, this turns out to be actually a better strategy. So off axis doesn't mean just looking away, it means putting it sideways but in a very particular way such that the target is on the slope, on the maximal slope of the emission beam of the bat.
So how exactly does the bat do this?
The answer is that really we don't know exactly how it works, how it does it so precisely. We do know that these bats emit sounds by tongue clicks, so they click the tongue. Pairs of clicks like that, and this has been known for many years. And what we think is the case is that the bats actually do not turn the head left-right. You see, those double clicks that I just demonstrated to you are much faster than this. They're separated by 20 milliseconds, 20 thousandths of a second, so it's all very rapid. And so it's not done by head movement. It's too fast for that. It's done by moving the tongue literally most likely, that's what we think, it's done literally by flipping the tongue from left side of the mouth to the right very quickly. And this way it emits the first lick on one side and the second lick on the other side. And so this is most likely the actual production mechanism, the sound production mechanism. But we focus less on the exact mechanism of how the tongue moves, but more on how the sound actually propagates in space and what does it give to the bat functionally in terms of its behavior.
So for a single returned signal or echo that goes back to the bat, it's either a huge signal if it hits the target, or it's really small or non-existent if it misses the target.
That's right. In principle, you're right. Though the beam, it's directional, but it's not very narrow. So it's not so easy to lose a target, but you definitely lose some strength of the returning echo. So what we think is that the bats actually are using those double clicks. They are doing, directing it left-right, right-left, left-right, right-left. And then they can compare between the left and the right click in each pair of clicks. And basically, as long as the returning echo is equal in amplitude between the left and the right, that means they're flying straight. If, let's say, the right click becomes stronger, it means they've deviated a bit too much to the left, and they need to correct to the right. So just by this simple comparison between the left returning echo and the right returning echo, they can keep moving forward towards the target. And that's something that hasn't been shown previously in bats.
Now, you said that the bat isn't turning its head. It doesn't have enough time.
Right.
Is it possible that the bat is just trying to find the edges of the target using this strategy?
So, a very good question. We've looked at that. And if that would have been the case, so if the case was that the bat is trying to emit the left click just to the left edge of the target and the right click to the right edge of the target, then we would expect that as the bat approaches the target, and, of course, the target gets larger and larger in appearance. So the angular extent of it gets larger and larger, then the angle between the left and the right beam should also grow accordingly. But this wasn't the case. So not at all. So there's no correlation with distance. That therefore, we think, or if there was a very weak correlation in the opposite direction, actually. So definitely not. That's not what the bats are doing. And we do think that what they are doing is putting the maximal slope of their emission on the target, which is the slope is the area which is most sensitive to changes in relative position of the bat and the target. And then if the bat just wants to use the amplitude of returning echoes, they can use this in an optimal way. Of course, the bat can also do many other things. Bats also can do what we do to measure directions of object, that is, measure time difference of arrival to the two ears, and other mechanisms. So all of these general mammalian mechanisms also work in bats, but these bats also have an extra mechanism that gives them an edge.
Now, you said that this strategy would be useful for localizing moving targets, like insects, say. These are fruit bats, so they're not doing that, I presume.
Right.
Have
right.
you and your team tested other echolocating animals, other bats?
Right. So first of all, it's very true. And all we can say is that this strategy is best for localizing, best tracking the relative angle, relative locations of the animal and the target. So remember, as the bat is trying to land, the bat itself is moving. And so it's still very useful to localize the precise position of the target if it's trying to land on a ball that's smaller than its own body size or on a piece of ceiling of a cave, things like that. We did not test this on other echolocating animals, but we actually predict that something similar would happen, but this would depend on the conditions. So people have tried, not just tried, they've published studies on similar experiments, similar in spirit, where insectivorous bats were catching small insects. And in this case, bats put the peak of their energy onto the target. And what we think is that they're doing this because a small insect is very difficult to detect. So if you face a detection problem, you want to put the maximal energy, the center of your beam, onto the target. But in our experiments, they had to land on a pretty big ball, so it was an easy target in terms of detection. And then for them, it was more important, the localization, to land accurately. And so they used the maximal slope. And our prediction is that if you do the same experiment in an insectivorous bat that has to land on a large target, it would do just the same. Only insectivorous bats don't use double clicks like our fruit bats, but they use single localization. So we predict that they would also put them off axis, but only on one side. So they'll be doing something like left, 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 consistently looking off axis on one side when they'll be facing such a situation. So that's why we think and we propose that there is a trade-off between detection or improving signal-to-noise on one side, which you do by putting the maximal energy on the target, and localization, which you do by putting the slope on the target. And we've actually done a separate experiment where we've made the task difficult for them in terms of detection. We've placed a large reflecting board just behind the target. So it's an acoustically reflecting board, reflects lots of echoes. So it becomes a noisy and difficult environment for them. And then these bats, on the fly, as we're approaching the target, switched from this slope strategy, this left, right, right, left strategy, they switched to putting the maximal energy onto the target, literally within a second. So it was all very fast, and they switched strategy literally on the fly. So this proves it's not necessarily a hardwired mechanism, but they can actually choose which strategy they want to use, depending on the conditions.
Nachum Ulanovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nachum Ulanovsky of the Weizmann Institute of Science on optimal localization by pointing off axis.
The president's budget for 2011 contains increases across the board for most research agencies. That's good news.
Science Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis writes in this week's issue about the U.S. budget for 2011 and the proposed spending for science and science agencies.
The challenge will be whether the news will stay good by the end of the year when Congress is finished going through the budget and putting its own priorities on it.
So far, how are members of Congress responding to this boost in science spending?
Well, we should probably go back a step. If you remember, the president in his State of the Union said he was going to impose a 3-year freeze on what's called discretionary domestic spending. That means things that you have a choice whether to fund and things that are not national security and defense related. Science, all of science fits into that category. So all of science is potentially vulnerable. That's why it was such a pleasant surprise to the community to see increases significantly above inflation, in some cases double digits, for certain agencies. The National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, Office of Science, National Institutes of Standards and Technology had all been promised increases that would lead to a doubling over 10 years, but a lot of people were skeptical that the administration would be able to keep that promise in light of its effort to reduce what's now $1.5 trillion deficit. Surprisingly, they did, at least in the budget proposal. And one of the ways they did that is by emphasizing the value of research and innovation in improving the economy in the long run. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, used to give a forward answer to the question of how we can dig ourselves out of the recession. Her answer was, science, 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 and science. Well, last week, when she was asked a similar question during an interview, her answer was jobs, 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 jobs. So the nice trick that science agencies, and I don't mean trick in a bad way, were able to pull in this year's budget was to link those two subjects, to make the case effectively to the White House budget office that science eventually translates into jobs. And in fact, better jobs than what's been lost, and that will eventually get us out of the recession, boost the economy, make us more competitive on a global scale, and raise standard of living. And in doing so, whittle the deficit at least a little bit.
But with a freeze on discretionary spending and science, as you say, being a part of that pie, I suppose there are members of Congress who are saying, hey, you've cut my program or cut what I want to spend money on and given it to science.
Right. Well, that's where how you cut up the pie matters. And without getting too technical, increases for one agency can affect increases for another agency, even if those two agencies don't do the same thing because of the way Congress appropriates money. So, for example, in NASA, where the administration has canceled a very costly program to go back to the moon and said instead we need to let the commercial sector do more of that, that's resulted in a theoretical savings of $1.5 billion. But Congress isn't likely to go along with that. And to the extent that they put money back into that, it may come out, literally, of the budgets of NSF, EPA, and the Department of Commerce because they're all funded from the same appropriations pot. So even though you may not think of climate change and going back to the moon and nanotechnology in the same breath, Congress does, because when it comes to passing out the money, they have a certain amount for each slice of the pie, and all of those science programs are in the same slice.
Before we get to further cuts, what scientific programs are getting more funding?
Well, to no one's surprise, the Obama budget request emphasizes a low-carbon economy and, to that extent, energy research that will help get us there. It emphasizes increased monitoring of the Earth to gauge the effect of global change and greenhouse gas emissions. It strengthens efforts to improve science education and education more broadly on the argument that we need a better trained workforce in order to be competitive. There are several science agencies that run programs in those areas, and they are all getting healthy increases, from the Department of Energy to the National Science Foundation to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
So now to the cuts. Are there any science agencies that are losing out on this budget?
Well, surprisingly, so far the list is fairly short. Within the Department of Energy, for example, there is cuts to the fusion program, and specifically the U.S. contribution to an international fusion reactor known as ITER. That raises questions in some people's minds about the viability of that project, which is being built in France through an international collaboration of nations.
An energy project, though. This seems counter to the rest of the Department of Energy's work.
Well, that's a good point, Rob. The answer, I think, the Energy Department and the White House would say is fusion is a long, long, long-range energy solution to our problems. There are much quicker, more technologically available and cheaper ways to improve efficiency and move away from fossil fuels than fusion. And that's where the money is going, whether that's alternative sources of energy, improving battery storage, improving the electricity grid, or just reducing energy usage. All of those things promise to have a bigger payoff sooner than fusion.
Okay. What else?
Within education programs, there is a shuffling. Some agencies are getting their programs strengthened, but at the same time, the Obama administration has said they're going to cut or reduce or eliminate programs that they feel are inefficient, and there are several small education programs that fit into that category. Of course, an inefficient program is in the eyes of the beholder, and that's, again, where Congress will have a big role, because in all likelihood, if history is any guide, Congress will not accept a lot of the proposed eliminations, and therefore will either have to take the savings from somewhere else or have to increase spending. And that's going to be a separate battle in itself.
Now, the Obama administration has publicly talked about wanting to fund autism research and cancer research. How's the new director of the National Institutes of Health, Francis Collins, responding to that?
Well, the NIH directors traditionally don't like to be told what areas are the most ripe for scientific exploration. But in this case, Francis Collins, the NIH director, feels that the Obama administration's interest dovetails with where the science is, specifically on genomic studies for both autism and cancer. He says that the community is primed to move ahead, and he welcomes the additional funding, doesn't feel like it's coming with inappropriate strings attached.
So what's the timeline? When does this budget get finalized?
Well, that's always an interesting question. It's supposed to be done by October 1st of the previous year, but Congress rarely meets that deadline anymore. So it will likely take longer. On the other hand, there's an election in November, and Congress will also want to have a completed budget that they can show the American people and say, here's how we dealt with the issues that are most important to you. So I think the current betting is that it will be done sometime in October, but what it'll look like is anybody's guess.
Jeffrey Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science's Jeffrey Mervis on U.S. President Obama's 2011 budget and the proposed spending for science and science agencies.
Finally today, Science's Lauren Schenkman is sitting in for David Grimm with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from Science Now, Science's online daily news site, including a story about foster care for chimpanzees. When does this happen, Lauren?
Well, researchers have seen that in the wild, sometimes if a young chimp loses its mother, that another chimp, completely unrelated, or even male chimps who rarely do this, will take them under their wings. And these researchers studying these chimps for 3 decades in Côte d'Ivoire saw that in that time they saw 18 cases of adult chimps adopting motherless chimps.
And what constituted an adoption?
Well, in order to say that an older chimp had really adopted a young chimp, they had to, for 2 months, do things like, you know, not leave them behind when they're moving to a new location, or make sure they have enough food and carry them around on their backs. And these are things that usually only mother chimps will do. But the researchers saw that the adult chimps were doing this for from 3 months to more than 5 years. So that seemed to be a really strong sign that it was truly an adoption and it wasn't a sort of temporary helping out sort of thing.
And because it was in the wild, not in captivity, right? It's not as if they learned these behaviors from people.
That's right, because there had been previous studies where chimps would seem to help each other without there being any benefit to themselves. But researchers had said, well, maybe they learned these behaviors from humans. But when you're seeing it in the wild, it seems to make a strong case that, you know, this could actually be real. But a lot of researchers are still very doubtful about this.
And this is an example of altruism, or what explains this behavior?
Well, we think of altruism as being something that's uniquely human, but it really does appear to be happening here. I mean, some other researchers have argued that maybe there's a benefit to the foster parent, that maybe, you know, he gets groomed more often, or when time comes for conflict with other chimps, you know, he has someone else on his side. But the same thing can be said for when humans do altruistic things, you might say. But I guess this behavior could be because maybe the adult chimps mistake the young chimps for their own offspring. And that's what other researchers have suggested.
Okay. So what's next? What other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, I've got 2 more animal stories today. And the first one is about turkeys. And in this case, we're talking about how turkeys were tamed, specifically in North America. And people had thought that the Mesoamericans, these are people who lived in the area from Mexico to Honduras, brought domesticated turkeys to North America, along with other things like corn and beans. But it looks like that's probably not the case. It looks like Native Americans in the Southwest probably tamed turkeys on their own.
So how did they know that?
Well, they looked at DNA. They looked at 38 archaeological sites in the Southwest, and from those sites, they collected about 200 bones and coprolites. And coprolites is a fancy name for really old poop. And it turns out that this poop really preserves DNA enormously well. So they were able to look at the DNA from turkeys who were living at these sites and compare them to DNA from Mesoamerican turkeys, from samples that they had in the Smithsonian, and then compare them also to the turkeys that are in the grocery store and also wild turkeys from all over the U.S. And what they found is that you would expect these southwestern turkeys to be very closely related to the Mesoamerican wild turkeys if those people had brought the turkeys with them to the Southwest. But they really didn't have much in common. In fact, the turkeys that the southwestern Native Americans had raised, they were really similar to wild turkeys found in the East Coast and in the Midwest, genetically. So it looks like those southwestern Native Americans might have gone east and gotten those turkeys and brought them back home.
Why would they do that?
Well, researchers speculate that it could have been because of their superior feathers. Around this time in the archaeological sites, it looks like rabbit fur blankets were being replaced by turkey feather blankets. So that could be one reason.
And which are the ones, the Mesoamerican turkeys or the ones that were domesticated by the southwestern Native Americans? Which of those are the ones that we eat now?
Well, it's kind of a roundabout story. It turns out that the turkeys we eat today were taken from Mesoamerica by the Spaniards in the 16th century to Spain and then brought back 100 years later as a food source. And so the descendants of those turkeys are pretty much what you buy at the supermarket. Now, this is a surprise in and of itself, but the real surprise in this story is the connection between the Southwest Americans and the East, because there's so many connections between the Southwestern Native Americans and the Mesoamericans, and not so many between those Southwestern Native Americans and the East Coast.
Okay, so last story. What's this last animal story about?
Well, you've heard of the Human Genome Project, but you may not have heard of the Horse Genome Project to map out the genes of horses. And just recently, a new company rolled out a DNA test for horses, and it costs 1,000 euros, and it can tell you something that racehorse breeders really want to know, which is whether their horse is likely to be a good sprinter or more of an endurance runner.
What are they testing for? Is it localizing performance to one gene?
Well, yes, according to the company. There was research published just last month that showed that there was one gene that had two variants, and one variant was correlated with horses who were likely to win races of up to 1.3 kilometers, so short races. And then there was another variant that was correlated with horses who did better in races of about twice that. So the idea is that if horses have this one variant, they have these compact muscles that are better for sprinting. And if they have the second variant, they're more naturally suited for endurance running. But, you know, they're saying this based on research that showed a correlation, and there's a lot of other things that come into account, a lot of other variants of genes. And there's also genes for things like aerobic capacity that the researchers haven't teased out the genetic components to yet. And that could also be really important when you're trying to predict whether a horse is going to win a race. So early days for this kind of research.
Okay, well, thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Rob.
Science's Lauren Schenkman sitting in for David Graham with a wrap-up of some stories from Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the February 5th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.